Minneapolis leaders are looking to run the city entirely on renewable energy. The city council and Mayor Jacob Frey want city facilities running on clean energy in the next 4 years. Their end goal is to have the entire city running on renewable energy by 2030.
That's WCCO-TV's Frank Vassalero talking about ambitious clean energy trends in Minneapolis. Today on ClimateCast, Minnesota's renewable energy revolution. Good morning, everybody. I'm Paul Huttner, sitting in for Carrie Miller today. Welcome to a special edition of ClimateCast. Renewable sources of energy now. Solar, wind, and hydro now play second in Minnesota's energy portfolio. 25%, that's the number of electricity is now generated in Minnesota, comes from renewables in 2017. And Minnesota's clean energy boom has become a driver of innovation, investment, and jobs. So today, we assess the state of Minnesota's renewable energy economy, infrastructure, and the potential for accelerated growth. What's the future of renewables in Minnesota? What benefits and challenges lie ahead? And how can you start using renewable energy today? We have a great panel today, but I also want to include your questions and comments and get you thinking. What changes have you made to embrace renewables in your life? How has it been working for you? If not, what's holding you back? If you own a business related to renewables, what benefits or challenges are you seeing? And we want to hear from you. 651-227-6000 if you're in the Twin Cities, or toll free 1-800-242-2828. Those are the numbers to call. You can also tweet me at MPR Weather, hashtag ClimateCast. Let's welcome our ClimateCast guests today. J. Dreg Hamilton is the Science Policy Director with Fresh Energy. Mike Cashin, Environmental Policy Advisor with Minnesota Power, based up in Duluth. Greg Mast is the Executive Director, Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. And Ellen Anderson, Executive Director of the University of Minnesota's Energy Transition Lab. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Jay, let's start with you. Big picture in Minnesota, where do we stand now with renewable generation capacity, and how quickly has that increased over the past decade or so?
So if you look at the last decade, in 2007, we were getting 7% of our in-state power from renewables.
Seven.
And wow. At the end of 2017, 25%. So I use this as a barometer. When you think nationally, people say, well, if you got 25% renewable electricity nationwide by 2040, that would be great. I say to them, Minnesota lays down the challenge. We've done it by 2025. Everyone else should be able to do so as well.
And how has that happened faster than projections about a decade ago?
Yeah, you know, this is about half a human generation. So What this means is that good, sound policy in Minnesota works. And I'll give you another example. Much of the past growth has been driven by wind. Wind is now cheaper than coal, and we should continue to drive forward with that. But we should plant a flag in Minnesota, because for solar energy between 2013 and the end of 2017 grew 40-fold. That's 4,000% because of cheap, desirable energy.
That's amazing. Mike Cashin, I'm curious about Minnesota Power's renewable portfolio. Where do you stand, and what are the trends for you the next few years?
Sure. Thanks, Paul. The portfolio at Minnesota Power has been trending along with Minnesota's. We are currently working what we call our Energy Forward program, where we're implementing a transition of how we do energy. Back in the 2005 timeframe, we started out with somewhere around 4 or 5% renewables, primarily from hydro. And since that time, we've set goals that run pace with the Minnesota targets. We're aiming to have about two-thirds of our energy supply from renewables in support of natural gas, and remainder a baseload of coal so that we can support our large industrial base. So we're at about 28% renewables now, which for a utility like ourselves is fast progress. Much of that is from wind. We have been locating that where the wind resource is best. We have a program.
And where is that?
That
where
is near Center, North Dakota, a lot of that. We also have a smaller wind resource up on the Iron Range. So we're taking advantage of DC power, which is more efficient for moving energy a long distance. So we're able to take that wind resource from the center of North Dakota and deliver it close to Duluth for utilization. And then we've also been developing more solar. And over at Camp Ripley, we have a 10-megawatt solar resource that started up a little over a year ago, which is 10 megawatts is a pretty good-sized solar farm, especially for this area. And we've opened up some community solar in the Duluth area. We have a WindSense program and a solar program where our customers can opt in to participate in that as they wish. And one of the more recent things, too, is we're providing for Manitoba Hydro to bring their run-of-river-style hydro into our area, too, so that we can use that for both energy and help stabilize our system with the kind of intermittency we get with our renewables bundle.
So that wind program, important to note, you don't need any facilities. You can just sign up for that through your utility. Is that correct?
Yes. We can, you can subscribe now through the utility as you wish, and we're building out more targeted to meet demand for that. We're also, through our Leak Clean Energy arm, building wind farms for support for other utilities.
All right. Greg Mast, let's talk about the cost of renewables versus coal and natural gas. Jay touched on this briefly. We know solar and wind costs have been falling tremendously fast. Where are costs now and where are those trend lines going?
Sure. Well, nice to join you, Paul. And when we think about costs for renewable energy, what we've seen is a continued plummeting of costs, primarily driven by technology advances. And so when we think about wind and solar resources on an unsubsidized basis, wind is now, in most locations, the lowest cost generating resource. And we're seeing solar also on an unsubsidized basis quickly becoming very cost competitive with your more traditional forms of electricity generation.
So wind is lower cost than what? Coal, nuclear, gas?
Just for a reference point, some recent studies have shown that on an unsubsidized basis, wind on a levelized cost of energy, so taking into account when these facilities are constructed and then as they are operating and also maintained over the lifetime, we're looking at $45 per megawatt hour unsubsidized compared to the average cost of a combined cycle natural gas plant at about $49 per megawatt hour. So we're seeing that clearly the wind is sort of behind our backs when it comes to this cost comparison for renewables that are quickly gaining a lot of momentum.
Ellen Anderson, we look at the overall balance of power generation in Minnesota. Now I think it's something like coal 39%, renewables 25%, nuclear 23%, natural gas 12%, give or take. I hope I'm close on those numbers. When we think of sort of a Venn diagram of how we produce power, I think of sort of three ovals. One is climate-friendly power, one is lowest cost power, and one is reliability. Where's the intersection of those three parameters for the right balance of power generation in Minnesota, and how much of that could ultimately be renewables?
Well, I think the sky's kind of the limit on renewables. We don't actually know what the upper ceiling is, but a lot of places like Minneapolis, as you started out with, have already pledged to get to 100% renewable energy. So I think the trajectory is going to take us to very, very high levels of renewable energy. It could be certainly 80% in Minnesota is very feasible and would align with our greenhouse gas goals that say we should have 80% carbon reduction by 2050 across the economy. So the coal portion of our energy mix is declining rapidly, and not just in Minnesota, but across the country. And there's been hundreds of coal plants that have retired. And so I think if you want to look to the future, I'll take your question as, where are we headed in
exactly.
the next coming
yeah.
decades?
Where are the trend lines going?
The trend lines are that coal is getting phased out, and it's just losing ground economically. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily going to happen because of regulations now. It's moved beyond that, and the momentum is that coal can't compete in the marketplace. Nuclear is still, obviously, we have a portion of our energy mix from nuclear in Minnesota, as you said, and it is carbon-free. Those nuclear plants are licensed to the early 2030s. And so XL Energy would like to keep them operating at least till then. it's the big question is what happens after that. But I think by 2030, the fact that the growth trajectory for renewable energy has been so fast, the increase that Jay talked about, mm-hmm. and the cost reduction has been so dramatic that as that momentum continues, I think that the there will be very fast increases in renewable energy to fill that void. So I think we could be at very high levels of renewable energy by the 2030s. And if I can say one more thing, there's a study underway right now that's sponsored by the state's energy office, Minnesota's energy office within the Department of Commerce. And they're modeling what it would look like to get to 10% solar by 2030 and 70% solar and wind combined with some energy storage and some management of load, in other words, mm-hmm. what all the customers do with their energy, that they're finding that levelized cost of energy is competitive with today's prices to do 70%. So we know that that's likely feasible. And our grid operators have figured out how to integrate large amounts of renewable energy. They're very good at it.
Let's talk about that increase a little bit in percentage, Jay. Now, I'm a good host. I lobbed you all kind of a softball question to start, right? But this is maybe a little bit of a hot potato. Several news outlets have reported that California now has so much solar power, they've had to turn off some of those sources temporarily to avoid overloading the grid. Jay Drake Hamilton, what's going on there, and could that happen in Minnesota? How do we avoid that kind of a scenario?
Well, I want to begin, Paul, answering that question by saying that our grid operators and our utilities have gotten very good, especially in Minnesota, where we started with wind back in the early 1990s. So we have a lot of experience integrating variable resources in Minnesota. And what listeners may not know is that the variability in wind and solar is mitigated quite a bit by the fact that we are part of a large grid. So in Minnesota, we're part of a 15-state and one Canadian province grid. And that geographic diversity means that the wind is always blowing somewhere and the sun is always shining somewhere.
So we're in a better position maybe than some grids across the country?
We're in a better position. We've actually done collaborative, detailed studies that have involved all of the participation of all the utilities in Minnesota. The last one was completed in 2014, and it was the Minnesota Renewable Energy Integration and Transmission Study. And that looked at how we could get to 40 and 50% renewable energy in our mix and do that reliably and affordably. And that study came out very well. And so we're quite a ways now from that kind of penetration, but we're starting to plan for that. So in Minnesota, as Ellen Anderson knows, there's quite a bit of research and interest in deploying and testing energy storage. Because here is a hot button that is tantalizing to a lot of people. Several years ago now, Xcel Energy, which operates in 8 states, in Colorado did a request for proposals for powering their system starting in 2023. And they came out with, they got astounding market numbers that wind and solar plus storage was cheaper than natural gas.
So this is really the key, isn't it? The battery technology, the storage technology, to be able to use that intermittent power
it. Yeah, actually, two things are key. That's going to be important going forward. But I think what people don't reflect upon enough is that there is a grid which acts as a storage capability and supplies reliability and affordability. And those grid operators, they're called MISO for Minnesota, do their jobs extremely well. And so what that means is there is a great diversity of resources in this 15-state, one-province grid, mm-hmm. and they take the cheapest sources of energy first and put them on the grid. And what that means is not every single power company on the grid needs to have enough storage to make or enough reliability measures to make up for times when the wind isn't blowing, because there's a grid that supplies that. And I remember the story from a couple of years ago when that grid that supplies Minnesota had about 200 wind farms on it. Mm-hmm. And they're spread out across that vast geography. And that means that helps us deploy wind. And what I think everyone knows about renewable energy is not only that it's zero carbon, but that it requires no fuel and no water. So your Venn diagram that you described mm-hmm. earlier, if you're interested in climate mitigation, if you're interested in saving money, and if you're interested in saving water, you should be heavily focused on renewable energy.
Can I jump in?
Go ahead.
And also respond to that question about California mm-hmm. that you brought up. And I think California's renewable energy supplies are growing so quickly that, yes, they're trying to figure out what to do with all that solar in the middle of the day when the sun is shining, but it's just a step along the way to this energy transformation. And there was a study that just came out from a national lab that looked at using electric vehicles, which California is also aggressively ramping up the electrification of transportation. And so this study said that with the electric cars that that are projected to exist in California in the coming years, they can soak up all that extra solar energy. And so the electric vehicles owned by millions of people will actually be another giant battery source that can be shared. And so we just need to figure out how to integrate all these things together. And a truly resilient, clean grid of the future is going to involve all those different moving parts. So it's complex and challenging, but we're figuring out how to do this in real time. So it's very exciting.
It is. A great big picture discussion there. Let's go to one person, okay, and find out how they can interface with renewable energy. Zach in Minneapolis, good morning. Do you have a question for the group?
Yeah, I do actually have a good question. Can you guys hear me?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Awesome. Brilliant. So I'm a fairly young fella. I'm 22, just graduated, got a job at an environmental engineering company, and I'm looking at buying a home for the first time in the next couple of years here. What's the best place to start if I want to get almost completely carbon neutral? Do I even have options for that at this point in time? I'm hearing a lot about offsets.
Great question. Thank you. Who wants it?
Thank you, Zach. And I would think about either designing or renovating the first home you purchase to make it sure that it is capable of doing the following things. First of all, chances are really good that for most households in Minnesota, your number one source of global warming pollution is the energy you use to heat and cool and power your home. So you need to figure out how your home can run within the next few years on electricity, because as the power grid gets decarbonized, which I described earlier, that's the way that you can go to zero carbon. You need to also have facility for charging an electric vehicle, if that's what you desire, and figuring out how to make that happen so that you can do it overnight when it's cheaper to do so. You can do it with wind or solar power, so that's also zero carbon. And then you should think about a storage capability, a household-sized storage capability that I think within the next 7 to 10 years is going to become cost-effective to allow you, as your home goes to all electric, zero carbon. So those two things are both important. There may be times when you're going to need a little bit of storage to help you out as well.
And let me just jump in, because the most important thing you should also start with is making sure your house is the most energy efficient house that you can possibly live in.
That's a huge opportunity, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's net zero homes being built all over the world right now that don't use much energy at all.
So the technology's already here.
Absolutely. And it pays for itself very quickly. So solar is wonderful, storage is wonderful, but you don't want to put those on a leaky house or you're just wasting money. So you need to reduce your energy budget for starters, and then you can add on clean energy production to have a perfect package.
Every dollar you spend on conservation means that's less money that you'll need to spend on renewable energy.
Smaller batteries, smaller system required.
Greg, let's talk about renewable energy subsidies. We know many industries and technologies that provide a benefit to our economy get government subsidies to help them grow. We know the oil and gas industry has received huge government subsidies. How should we think about incentives for renewable energy? Have they worked, and are costs now competitive, as you pointed out earlier, even without incentives?
Well, I think that incentives certainly play an important part whenever we're talking about bringing something new to market. And so when we think about clean energy and renewable energy, I will point out that, not to get down the rabbit hole of incentives across the energy industry,
sure.
But I think from a federal policy perspective, wind and solar are really the only two industries that are phasing out federal tax incentives. And so wind, that tax incentive is going to be phased down and then will be completely gone by 2019. And with solar, that's also ratcheting down and will be only in existence for 10% for commercial customers after 2022. And so I think that the industries are acknowledging that we have come so far with advances in technology that we no longer need to be incentivized for getting further deployment. And I just also want to talk a little bit about just the demand that we're seeing from customers.
Please.
And just like the caller who called in, I think that what we're seeing is this intensified demand from consumers, mm-hmm. energy consumers, as well as from businesses, and as you led off the program, from communities who are really seeing this transition to cleaner, affordable, reliable energy as a big economic opportunity, as well as providing environmental and social benefits. And so when we think about the business community, and we work a lot with the business community, that's where when you think of Fortune 100 companies, we have over two-thirds of those Fortune 100 companies now have some type of greenhouse gas, renewable energy, or energy efficiency target. When we look at Fortune 500 companies, nearly half of them have that. And so we're seeing a very strong trend and movement towards incorporating these energy efficiency and clean energy technologies into their operations. And it's really being driven by massive cost savings, as well as mitigating risks within their supply chains. And then lastly, really responding to the demands of consumers. This is the type of energy and the types of products and the types of services that people expect and what they want.
Mike, you're one of those people, a utility in Duluth with customers. Are you seeing that demand?
There is demand, definitely. I think that in Duluth, we have, of course, our program subscription. We have a few parties that have sought to put in a all-electric and sustainable resource, certainly. Mm-hmm. One of the things that, to just give a little bit more perspective to the question, is it was raised, how can we be sustaining or zero emissions-based home? And I think Jay had touched on the point where we have a grid. It allows us to balance the demands on the system that are created with the intermittent renewables through the grid. And so we need to look at this in sort of a two-pronged approach. One is taking care of the energy. You know, you can subscribe for renewables, and the renewables might be happening during the peak of the day from solar or whenever we have our wind resource going. But then there's the in-between periods where we need to keep reliability in order so that 24/7, round-the-clock electricity supply is there for when customers need it. And I see that's where the renewables challenge is starting to emerge, and that when we started this back in 2005, I call it headroom. There's lots of reserves, spinning reserves in the system, mm-hmm. in the grid to accommodate these intermittent resources, and we've been doing that very well. Now we might have generation from several states away balancing what Minnesota resources are doing. But as we have higher levels of deployment, more intensity, we're starting to bump into some of the boundaries on what the system can support, and we're needing to put in additional measures.
And sure.
As a utility, we have such measures to do, but it's a factor that's coming into play now more so than it did a decade ago.
And as we're hearing, the technology is playing a role in how we advance that power blend going forward. We only have about a minute left. I want to get a real quick reaction from a couple of you on jobs in Minnesota. Jay, how about renewable energy jobs? Where are we now? What's the number? Do they pay well?
Since 2006, we've grown 57,000 clean energy jobs. They pay 42% higher than the state average wage. 30% of them are in greater Minnesota. This is a great victory, and we should strive for even bigger results in Minnesota.
Ellen, big picture on climate. Are the changes happening fast enough to make a real difference on climate? Is technological optimism on renewables too optimistic? You know, what do you think? Some of the climate scientists saying we need to move really fast to get there to make a difference.
If we want to meet the global Paris Agreement goals of trying to limit warming to 2 degrees, and that's the more attainable goal. There's actually a more rigorous goal, but the official one is 2 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. And if we want to give our kids and that generation a fighting chance, we have to accelerate all of these much, much faster. And the good news is that the renewable energy economy is raring to fill that void, and we can make it happen. But we need to have strong policies across state, across governments. We need individual participation. We have to figure out how everybody can participate in this renewable energy revolution, whatever their income level, wherever they live. And so we have a lot of work to make that happen, but we can do it.
Ellen Anderson, Executive Director of the University of Minnesota's Energy Transition Lab. Greg Mast, Executive Director, Clean Energy Economy, Minnesota. Mike Cashin, Environmental Policy Advisor, Minnesota Power in Duluth. And J. Drake Hamilton, Science Policy Director with Fresh Energy. A great and insightful discussion today, you guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Dana Jackson. I live in Stillwater, Minnesota.
I'm Heather Rutledge. I'm Executive Director at ArtReach St. Croix, and I live in Stillwater, Minnesota. In 2016, we received a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts for the Big Read, where we were encouraging people all over the St. Croix Valley to read John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. A friend of mine had told me about Cli-Fi, and I investigated what other titles we could incorporate and how to read The Grapes of Wrath as a climate fiction book.
The Grapes of Wrath, of course, was not written about climate change, but it was written about the aftermath of drought, which causes people to have to leave their homes and migrate, which is a very real part of the impacts of climate change worldwide. So the relevance was very clear. The Jodes, when they go to California and they are treated so badly, as migrants are, they are invaders and they are sensed as competition. They were treated so badly, but the Jodes and the people whom they knew treated each other beautifully. So there's scenes in The Grapes of Wrath where they are with so little food, and yet they help feed others. And so there's kindness and human virtues that come through, and we hope that will always be the case, no matter what the situation is. So we discuss that.
I think it might be something I would encourage people to pick a Cli-Fi title and insert it into their ongoing book clubs. Dana and I were debating whether you could really do a Cli-Fi book club forever, because it really is putting yourself into a situation that it can get a little overwhelming at times, but great opportunities to talk about what might be.
It's a way of talking about other people, not ourselves, but as we talk about how other people are surviving, treating each other, thinking through solutions. And we have to focus on solutions. It helps us. Just reading a book and then going somewhere and talking about that book to other people, expressing your fears, expressing your hopes, letting some emotions come out. I think that's very useful.
If you want to learn more about climate fiction, we've posted a feature on Cli-Fi with some suggestions to get started at nprnews.com. Also today, stay tuned. At noon, we're going to have on NPR News Presents a new program from Climate One, the series. This one about the hidden health hazards of climate change. Allergies, asthma, diseases spread by ticks and mosquitoes. It's all changing. That's at noon today on NPR Presents. But now I want to turn to another developing climate change impact, and that's the scarcity of water. Colorado River water is the lifeblood for millions of people in California, Nevada, Utah, Arizona. Now federal forecasters say there are a better than even odds that the nation's largest reservoir will continue to decline to shortage conditions by 2020. That would force Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico residents to reduce their Colorado River water use. Jonathan Overpeck is the dean for the School of Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. He's been a lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports. He's also considered one of the world's leading experts on climate change and impacts on water resources on the Colorado River and in the Southwest. I first interviewed Jonathan in Arizona over a decade ago, and he joins us today from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Jonathan, it's good to talk with you again.
It sure is.
Let's talk about the current state of flow on the Colorado. The Southwest has been in a drought for almost, 20 years now. How has that impacted the Colorado River flow over the past few decades?
Yeah, you know, the Colorado River serves seven states and Mexico, probably pushing 40 or 50 million people, depending on how you look at it, and a lot of agriculture. And the flows have, as you mentioned, have started plummeting in the earliest part of this century. Since 1999, essentially, Colorado River has been in drought.
And let's talk about the reality that people are facing as that trend continues. What do you say? How many people rely on the Colorado River for their daily water? Is it 40 million?
40 million is a good number. Some people say 50, some people say a little less, but I think 40 is a really good number.
And you, I know, study what we call mega droughts. These are these long duration droughts. Talk a little bit about the current mega drought in the Southwest.
Well, the current mega drought, you know, it's interesting because we define mega drought in the Southwest as a drought lasting decades, meaning 20 years or longer. So this drought is right on the cusp of becoming a mega drought, and it's moved around in the West and in the Southwest over the last 19 years now. Sometimes it's worse in California. Sometimes it's worse out on the panhandle of Texas, Oklahoma region. Sometimes it's worse up in Colorado. But it's always been in and around the Four Corners region, and particularly in Arizona, New Mexico, over that long period of time. And some years have been really dry. Some have been not so dry. And we've been lucky that the infrastructure, the dams on the Colorado, the reservoirs on the Colorado, they've been able to buffer the impacts of this drought. But now these big reservoirs, the largest two reservoirs in the United States, Lake Powell and Meade, are collectively a good deal less than half full. And as these flows continue to go down even further, we're worried that we're going to reach an official shortage. And this would really be a shock to the Southwest.
So I'm curious about the signals here, the longer-term climate signals. Mega drought, yes, we're on the cusp of that. Or is this climate change? I mean, when does mega drought sort of become climate change, if you know what I'm getting at?
This is a good debate. This drought contrasts with previous droughts we've had in the Southwest. The previous droughts were driven by lower precipitation than normal. This drought, there have been some dry years for sure, but it's been driven more by the elevated temperature. So it really appears that most of the reductions in river flow in the Colorado and Rio Grande and other rivers in the Southwest, they're being driven by anomalously high temperatures, and these high temperatures, of course, are the local or regional symptoms of global warming. So as we get more and more warming around the planet, we get more and more in the Southwest, and we get, as a result, less and less flow in our rivers. So this could be going into a drought that, in theory, will never end unless we can really put the brakes on climate change.
You know, one thing, Jonathan, I noticed during my 9 years in the Southwest is that even small climate shifts can have sort of an outsized impact in these marginal climate zones that maybe get just enough rain or snow to get by. Why are even small climate shifts important in places like Arizona and the Southwest?
Well, it's just as you said. I mean, these are marginal areas already. You know, I think the first explorers of the Southwest all noted this is going to be a tough place to live, and it's through our ingenuity in damming rivers and using water wisely, we've managed to have a thriving economy and good quality of life down in the Southwest. But as we warm things up, it's essentially, you know, driving us back across that tipping point into maybe a much less sustainable climate with a lot less water coming down these rivers. And if, at the same time, of course, everyone in America has noticed the uptick in large wildfires. And believe it or not, there are just whole areas of forest in the Southwest that are dying outright just because of the warming. Then the insects, and then you get the wildfires. On top of that, you're getting a major transformation. It's not just in the rivers. And it's a big question is what's that going to mean about the future economy and quality of life in the region? And people are grappling with that now because it could get a whole lot worse if we don't tackle climate change.
Well, and that's exactly my next question, and I want to take it in two parts. First of all, the economy of the Southwest largely is based on water, and correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't many of the assumptions for the flow in the Colorado determined during the 1920s, which was the highest flow decade on record, but we haven't seen that kind of flow since. So what is that doing to our assumptions about water on the Colorado?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned sort of one of Mother Nature's biggest jokes on the Southwest. You know, they were dividing up the Colorado back in the starting in the 20s. And that turns out, we now know from tree ring records, to have been one of the very wettest periods in the last 1,200 or longer years. So we divided up more water than normally flows, maybe about 15% more water than normally flows. And that was no problem for decades. But in the 1990s and into this century, of course, more and more people keep moving to this fastest growing region of our country. And so now we need all that water, and it's all allocated, and yet even in a normal good year, we don't have as much as that's allocated. And then the climate change is on top of that. And the climate change in this drought, we've had about a 19% reduction in river flows in the Colorado. The Rio Grande is having, over New Mexico, is having one of the very worst years ever this year. And so these are symptoms of much bigger problems to come, as the continued warming will continue to reduce these flows, maybe as much as by a half later in this century.
And what are the, what's the bottom line impacts here? If we talk economically, for example, I mean, this may be shallow, but a lot of Minnesota and Michigan folks where you are snowbirds own property in the Southwest. Are there impacts ahead potentially on real estate value, agriculture? Give us the concerns that people are thinking about.
Well, I'll circle around to the real estate, you know, but really what it means first and foremost is the obvious, is there'll be less water. And if there's a shortage, and there's a 50% chance now, more than 50% chance of an official shortage, the first ever on the Colorado in 2020. And when that occurs, Arizona's going to get 11% less water. Nevada's going to get less water. Mexico's going to get less water. But, you know, there's just going to be a lot of concern and angst when this happens. And the question will be, what will investors say about investing in new home developments, investing in municipal bonds for in the region, and other types of businesses moving there? And as someone who just moved from Arizona, I have to say, my wife is also another climate scientist, it was in the back of our minds that we were making a sound investment buying property in Michigan and selling in Arizona, because we're worried that when, you know, the cow pie hits the fan, that real estate values could tank again. And we saw that in 2008, and I'm just worried that the shock of not enough water could do that again.
Jonathan, we've got a little over a minute left. I'm curious about your biggest message for people about climate change. You do a lot of talks. You talk to a lot of people. I'm sure you have normal friends in your daily life. How do you make climate change real to the people you talk with?
In the Southwest, it's not hard. Everybody there knows the climate change is going on. And believe it or not, 75% of Southwesterners know it's due to humans. It's just not high enough on their priority list. And I would say we better start making it a top priority if we want a vibrant Southwest. And it's just like along the coastlines of the Gulf and Atlantic coasts. Those two are being flooded by climate change. And we're seeing clear signs of it happening. There's no doubt about that anymore. And it just means it's going to get worse and worse if we don't tackle climate change. And the cost to everyone, including in the Midwest, will be high, because we pay for the insurance, we pay for the taxes that bail these things out. So this is a national problem of mounting importance.
Jonathan Overpeck, great discussion. Dean of the School of Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. Thanks for your work and thanks for your insight today.
Thanks, Paul. I really appreciate you taking interest in these important topics.
That's ClimateCast today. Thanks for listening. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner.